Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Take One. This is your host, Juan Pablo Sá, talking to you from the CITR station at UBC Point Grey Campus, located in the unceded territory of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nation. Okay, I am back once again. For those of you who have been listening to Take One every Tuesday from 3 to 4 p.m. at CITR 101.9 FM, for those of you who have been listening, you are aware that I have been covering the 42nd Vancouver International Film Festival. I was able to do a bunch of interviews that I am very proud of, and I was also able to watch 22 total movies for the duration of the film festival. I had a great time. I absolutely loved it. Once again, thank you so much to Viv. Thank you to everyone involved for giving me such an amazing experience and for giving us, Vancouver, such a great experience. So yeah, in the previous episodes, I've been showing you guys some of the interviews that I did. These interviews were with Sarah Greenwood and Katie Spencer, the production designer and set decorator of Barbie. Also, I interviewed Sam Green, the director behind the live documentary 32 Sounds. And I also interviewed Karsten Wall, an NFB filmmaker who recently did a short documentary called Modern Goose. Those were the interviews that I've been playing in the past couple of weeks. If you guys are interested in listening to any of these, definitely check them out at the CITR website. Just, you know, look for Take One, click on the interviews, and you'll get them. On top of that, bunched with these interviews, I've also been letting you guys listen to some of my reviews for two movies that came out at this year's film festival. One of those films was Priscilla, which is Sofia Coppola's newest film. And then another movie review that you guys have probably listened to already was one for The Boy and the Heron, which is the newest film from director Hayao Miyazaki, who of course is, you know, one of the founders of Studio Ghibli and one of the best animated directors of all time. So that's what you guys have already listened to. That is what I covered in previous episodes. But now, today, in this episode, I am going to talk about the first half of all the movies that I saw at this year's Vancouver International Film Festival. I will be giving you guys a short review for each one of these movies, followed by a score from 1 to 10. I was able to watch some incredible films, so without further ado, here is Everything I Watched at VIFF, Part 1. And here we go. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Take One. Okay, for those of you who don't know, the Vancouver International Film Festival happened here in Vancouver from the 28th of September until the 8th of October. These are the movies that I saw before the festival began via ScreenerLink. So the first film that I actually watched was Totem, which Totem, for those of you who don't know, is a small Mexican film that is actually, this film, Totem, is actually Mexico's submission for Best International Feature at the 2024 Oscars. And I love Totem. I thought it was a gorgeous, incredibly subtle, incredibly understated film that is yet able to pack a very powerful punch and convey a very powerful message. This is a movie that is very much told from the perspective of the main character, who is a younger child, you know, a young girl. And this film plays beautifully with her perspective, with the fact that the whole story is told from her perspective. So basically, for those of you who don't know, the story of Totem is pretty much, there's this young girl, she's dealing with some hard stuff in her life. Mainly, her father is very ill, and, you know, he won't be living forever. That said, due to the fact that this whole movie is told from the perspective of the girl, we see the illness of the father from a very naive, from a very innocent perspective. You know, from the perspective of a child who doesn't really know death, you know, who hasn't really been touched by some of these, you know, calamities or by some of the biggest tragedies of life. So we see this film from this very naive, innocent perspective, and it is just absolutely heart-wrenching to see this girl just navigating her life, being kind of unaware of this horrible, very tragic and sad thing that is happening, you know, right next to her that she doesn't really quite comprehend. This movie is filled with some beautiful, magical moments. There is a scene where the main girl is pretending to sing that it was just absolutely charming, absolutely enchanting. That said, this film might not be for everyone because this is very much a plotless movie. This is very much a slice of life film. You're following the life of this girl, you know, going through her day-to-day life, playing, doing chores, doing different things. But there isn't really a story. There isn't really like an antagonist or something that we're building up. Well, there is something that we're building up to that is very sad. But, you know, not like in a conventional narrative way, I guess. So it might not be for everyone, but you know, if this sounds for you, like, you know, a slice of life kind of slow movie where you're just following this girl as she lives her day-to-day life, then this might be the movie for you. I found it charming, I found it heart-wrenching, and the ending was so powerful. Of course, no spoilers, but I am just very impressed with just how much the very ending, the final shots of the movie were able to convey without any words, without any explanations, without holding your hand or, you know, spoon-feeding you what's actually happening, just by visuals. The last couple of shots of this movie are able to convey so much. And it is simultaneously sad, heart-wrenching, but it is also a beautiful, beautiful movie. So I'll definitely be rooting for this one. I hope this one gets nominated for Best International Feature. I absolutely love Totem. And if I were to give Totem a score between 1 and 10, I would give it an 8 out of 10, which means I thought this film was great. Now, the next movie I watched before the festival began was another Latin American film. And this one was Chronicles of a Wandering Saint, or Las Crónicas de una Santa Errante. And I also love this movie. I thought this film was incredibly charming and incredibly unique. And that is what I love the most about this film, its uniqueness. So the main character in this film, Chronicles of a Wandering Saint, is basically this older woman who is faking all of these miracles, who is pretending that she can do all of these miracles just to gain some status, you know, to gain some clout amongst her group of church-going friends. Come on, that in and of itself is incredibly quirky and incredibly original, but you know, the film doesn't just stop there. That is the setup, that is how the movie begins, but the film completely reinvents itself halfway through. At the halfway point, the movie changes drastically, and honestly, when I was watching this at home in my computer, you know, my jaw was dropped, I had no idea what was going on, and part of me wished I would have watched this in theaters, because part of me was like, oh my god, I need to know how people, how audience members reacted when, you know, the thing that happens in the middle of this movie actually happens. Of course, no spoilers, but yeah, I loved it. I really, the way this film reinvents itself is really charming, really unique, really quirky. This film is also full of some great comedic moments. It is full of some great conversations and some beautiful, beautiful visuals, particularly in the second half of the film, which I won't say anything about the second half of the film, but there are some great, visually striking, visually rich moments. I would also give Chronicles of a Wandering Saint an 8 out of 10. It is a great, great film. Now, the next movie I saw was a film called Humanist Vampire Seeking Consenting Suicidal Person. And I like this movie. I like Humanist Vampire Seeking Consenting Suicidal Person. I think the title is great. I freaking love the title. That is what drew me the most towards the movie. And I think the film is just as quirky and charming as its title. The protagonist is very quirky and charming. The cinematography is very quirky and charming. And the film is full of quirky and charming moments. I think my favorite moment of the film, without giving away any spoilers, is there's a part where two characters are just vibing to music, kind of dancing, kind of bobbing, and I thought that was, you know, beautifully encapsulated what this movie was. That said, I didn't love this movie as much. I like it, I think it's a good film, but I think the thing that worked the least for me was, A, the world building. I thought the world building was kind of weak, especially because, you know, we're dealing with vampires, we're meant to believe that these characters have been doing what they do for hundreds and hundreds of years, and yet they were like, they were so sloppy in like an unrealistic way that it kind of took me out of the movie. And I'm like, I don't know if this were real vampires, which, I mean, there are no real vampires, but if they were real vampires, I'm sure they will have, you know, some better rules, some better guidelines. They would be doing things in a less sloppy way than, you know, this film shows us. And then something else that didn't really work for me about Humanist Vampire Seeking Consenting Suicidal Person, long-ass title, something else that didn't work for me was, I feel like after the first third of the movie, there is this male character that gets, you know, thrust into the story as kind of a co-lead. And I don't know. I didn't really like the direction in which this male character took the story. I thought it was good. I thought it was fine. But I thought the other story about, you know, this humanist vampire and her relationship with her family, that is what I really, really loved. In conclusion, I like Humanist Vampire Seeking Consenting Suicidal Person, and I would give it a 6 out of 10. A very solid 6 out of 10. Almost a 7, I guess I should say. Then the next movie I watched before the festival actually began was called Red Rooms. And this is one of the most disturbing and effed up movies I've ever seen. Red rooms are places where, you know, women, particularly younger women, get kidnapped and get tortured. And usually the stuff that happens in these red rooms gets live streamed in the deep web for, you know, depraved people who are willing to pay a lot of money to get access to these videos. And this, you know, this movie focuses very much on red rooms. And it is kind of a courtroom drama where two women who are obsessed with this guy, with this horrible human being who is accused of doing all of that, of torturing younger women, of kidnapping younger women and torturing them in red rooms. And the movie follows these two characters who are just obsessed with this guy for different reasons, which I won't delve into because I don't want to spoil anything. But yeah, even though it is an incredibly disturbing movie, and even though it is incredibly hard to watch at times, I thought this movie was amazing, exceptionally well made. The movie does an incredible job of putting you in the shoes of a character you don't want to be in the shoes of. You don't want to be in the shoes of the protagonist. The protagonist is not a nice person. She is not a good person, but she's a fascinating person, and that makes it worth it, in my opinion. There are some haunting scenes, some moments that, you know, just gave me shivers. Yeah, extremely well-made movie with some incredibly poignant moments. This is a movie that perfectly understands that sometimes what is not shown to the viewers could be even more scary than what is. You know, usually when you watch a movie and there's like a gory scene, it's just that, you know, it's gore. You can see the gore. But sometimes when you watch a movie and there's a gory scene happening or there's a violent scene happening, but they don't show you the violence. You know, you hear the screams and you hear what's going on, but you don't really see what's taking place. Sometimes that can be even more effective. This film just uses that cinematic technique perfectly. You know, the idea that what is not shown is even more scary than what is. So I have to give extra points for that. This film is just expertly made, expertly crafted. The last thing I'll say, this is just a little anecdote, this is not really about the movie, is, once again, I watched this movie via screener link. And for those of you who don't know, usually when they send you a link to be able to watch a movie from your computer, some of them come with like with watermarks, you know, with like a little sign that says Juan Pablo Sai, you know, that says my name on the screen so that the studio can make sure that I'm not screenshotting the film and that I'm not screen recording the film. And I'll just say that it was a wild experience to see this very disturbing, dark movie and then see my name on screen, you know? Some very disturbing things were happening in the film, and then I just look to the right and I just see Juan Pablo Sa, and I was like, oh boy, this is weird. But yeah, you know, first time for everything, I guess. But, you know, overall, great experience. Thank you for sending me a screener link. If I were to give it a score in between 1 and 10, I would give it a 9 out of 10. I think this film is amazing. It is hard to watch. It is not for everyone. It is very, very disturbing. But it is an amazing piece of cinema that uses cinematic language in a perfect, perfect way. Now, another film that I saw before the festival actually began is one called I Used to Be Funny, and it stars Rachel Sennett, and I was really excited for this movie because I love Rachel Sennett. I love what I've seen of her. I absolutely adore Shiva Baby, and I thought her performance in Shiva Baby was absolutely incredible. I also really love Bottoms, which recently came out, and, you know, her performance in Bottoms was also hysterical, and I love Bodies, 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 which, by the way, I reviewed in this channel, like, you know, around a year ago, and her performance in Bodies, 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 I also thought was pretty, pretty exceptional. So I was very excited for this one. I was very excited for It Used to Be Funny. But I'm sad to say that I didn't like this one. It wasn't for me. And I guess the best way I could put it is I found this film incredibly cringy, incredibly cheesy in a very, very cringy way. And I'll just give you an example. I'll give you an example of what I mean. This film is full of scenes where Rachel Sennett is just sighing, thinking about the past, and then she finds a Polaroid picture and she looks at the Polaroid and she is reminded of the perfect life that she used to have, and then she sighs, and then like a little string guitar in the background starts playing, and then it fades to a flashback where we see the happy moment that Rachel Sennett is remembering. So you see what I mean? That's the level of cringe and cheesiness that I'm talking about. And, you know, it might just be me. It might just be me, because I have friends who have watched I Used to Be Funny, and they really loved it. They thought it was great. So it might just be me, but I just could never get into this film. I found it very cringy, very cheesy. There are some effective moments. There are some good moments, and Rachel Sennett's performance is once again incredible. She's doing her best. She's doing her best with what she's given. If I were to give I Used to Be Funny a score in between 1 to 10, I'm sorry, I'm sad to say this, but I would give it a 5 out of 10. I thought it was pretty meh. There's some good stuff, but it's pretty mediocre in my opinion. Now, the last film that I saw before the festival actually began was absolutely amazing. It was a documentary called 32 Sounds, which, for those of you who are, you know, who've watched all of Taekwon videos, you know that I a couple of days ago, I released an interview with Sam Green, the director of 32 Sounds. And in order to prep for that interview, they sent me a screener link for this documentary, for 32 Sounds. I absolutely loved it. I thought this documentary was just mind-blowingly good. I thought it was incredible. I thought it was unlike anything I've ever seen before. I think on my Letterboxd review, when I reviewed 32 Sounds, I think I wrote something along the lines of, like, you know, it feels like a disservice to call 32 Sounds a documentary, because, you know, more than that, it is just this incredible sensory experience that engages with your sense of hearing like nothing I've ever seen before. Once again, I loved it. It's a fascinating documentary. It is a documentary that is all about the relationship between humans and sounds, you know, the relationship between humans and our sense of hearing. And as the title implies, it takes us in this beautiful sonic journey through 32 different sounds that, in my opinion, beautifully encompass what it means to be a human and what it means to hear. The different applications, the different ways sound surrounds us. And I generally believe if you watch 32 Sounds, you'll never listen to the world in the same way. I won't delve deep into this one because, once again, there is already an interview in my channel. But what I'll say is, what fascinated me about this documentary is, for those of you who don't know, Sam Green makes live documentaries. And basically what that is he turns documentaries into this live in-person theatrical events. He turns documentaries into theatrical experiences. Even though 32 Sounds is one of Sam Green's live documentary, and he did perform it live here at the Vancouver International Film Festival, he did mention in the interview that it will eventually come out as a conventional documentary on iTunes. So if you stumble onto 32 Sounds at one point, definitely check it out. It is an amazing experience. It is a documentary unlike any I've ever seen before. And Sam Green was just, you know, an absolute delight. I loved interviewing him. I'm very proud of that interview. So if this piques your interest, definitely check that out. But yeah, that is everything I watched before the festival actually began. Then on the 28th of September, the festival began, but we're going to talk about that on the next part of this series. But that is it for part one. Thank you for watching. Goodbye. Everybody, and welcome back to Taekwon, and welcome to part two of Everything I Watched at VIFF. Okay, so the first movie I saw at this year's festival in person, in a theater, was The Teacher's Lounge. What I love the most about this film is that the school, or the Teacher's Lounge in particular, in this film acts as a microcosm of society in and of itself. This movie in its entirety is focused on the idea of, you know, where does evil come from? And can we stop evil? Can we stop evil from existing? And, you know, what is evil in society? Is it one bad apple? Is it a couple of bad apples who do the evil inside this, you know, big basket of apples? Or is the basket in and of itself rotten? Is the basket the one that is bad? Is the basket the one that is turning the apples evil? Okay, I'll begin by saying that in the school where the film takes place, there are some robbery incidents happening. Basically, the students are stealing in classrooms, but also there is someone stealing in the teacher's lounge. So it creates this pretty hopeless situation in which we have children that are being taught by these professors that are being formed into the future of Germany, into the future of this city. And yet these professors are just as bad and, you know, do the exact same thing that the children are. So, you know, if the role models for these children are also stealing and are also doing all of this stuff, then, you know, how can we expect the children to be any different? So at points, this movie can be very hopeless because it touches upon that. It touches upon this endless cycle where one generation after the other, and it just never gets broken. The system in and of itself is broken and is, you know, it's lending itself for these instances to exist, you know, for this evil to pop up in society, I guess. And at the center of it all, the main character, she's basically a teacher who is fed up with this, who she's trying her best to be a role model for her students. She's trying her best to just teach good moral and good ethics into her students. And yet, you know, she finds herself trapped in this cobweb of mistrust and this cobweb of you know, hidden interests in every one of the characters. I thought the buildup of tension in this film was absolutely incredible. I thought the red herrings, the misdirections, the different perspectives, you know, the exploration of the idea of truth and the idea of is there such a thing as an objective truth? These are some of the questions that this movie, The Teacher's Lounge, is very much interested in tackling. I love this movie. I thought the performances were incredible. I thought the buildup of tension, once again, was amazing. I thought the way the school in and of itself was a microcosm for society was very thought-provoking and very philosophically rich. I do have two complaints about this film, and first of all, I thought some moments in the film were a bit melodramatic, a bit unrealistic. I can't give examples because I don't want to give anything away, but there are some moments that I'm like, come on. Come on, really? And then my last complaint about the movie is, in my opinion, I think this movie was just missing an ending. I feel like it didn't have an ending. You know, we had this incredible buildup, incredible, incredible buildup, but then we never get to see things explode. We never get to see things reaching that climax. And, you know, I know I've thought about it for a while, and I've asked myself, you know, maybe the film is trying to make a statement about the fact that things in real life don't get resolved, you know, and that's why the ending is ambiguous, so that we viewers, we can draw our own conclusions and we can conclude what we want. And, you know, that's how real life works. But I don't know. For me, it felt a bit like a cop-out. It felt like you did a beautiful job building up everything, building up this tension, but then right when you had to cash in that check, you know, right when you were going to give us the payoff, you just didn't. The movie just ended. So that was a bit of a letdown for me, but it's minor. All in all, The Teacher's Lounge, I think it's a great movie. And if I were to give it a score between 1 to 10, I would give it an 8 out of 10, which means I thought it was great. Now, the next movie I saw was Evil Does Not Exist. So Evil Does Not Exist is the newest movie from director Ryusuke Hamaguchi, who, for those of you who don't know, he recently directed Drive My Car, which ended up getting nominated for Best Picture. I'm not the biggest fan of this filmmaker. You know, I'll preface my review by saying this. I am not the biggest fan of this filmmaker. I didn't really love Drive My Car. I thought Drive My Car was very, very long and very boring. I don't have a problem with slow cinema. I'm okay with slow cinema. I like slow movies if by the end of the film you feel like it was all worth it. You feel like, yeah, okay, it was slow, but you know, the film took me in this journey, and by the end, I feel like I get it. It was necessary. What I do have a problem with is slow movies that, in my opinion, just go nowhere. Those are the films that I call boring. That is what, in my opinion, is the difference between slow cinema and boring cinema. And if you ask me, Drive My Car was pretty boring. I think what didn't work the most for me about Drive My Car is I didn't feel like it was building up to anything. It felt incredibly meandering, which is intentional. You know, the whole point of Drive My Car is to follow this character as he mourns, you know, and he's mourning and they drive and he's mourning and they drive. So Drive My Car, not the biggest fan of. But this one, Evil Does Not Exist, I went to this movie because it once again got good reviews coming out of Cannes. I thought the title was very interesting, you know, as a philosophy student. I love movies that tackle the idea of, you know, good and evil, and what does it mean to be good, what does it mean to be evil. So, you know, when you make a movie with a title as thought-provoking as Evil Does Not Exist, come on, of course I'm gonna go watch it. And I think I'm in the minority by saying this, but I like this more than Drive My Car. I thought Evil Does Not Exist was actually quite good. I didn't love it. I didn't think it was a home run, but I thought it was good. The first 20, 30 minutes of the film, it lost me. I was having flashbacks to Drive My Car. I was like, oh my god, here we go again. A very slow movie with beautiful cinematography that ends up going nowhere. That said, after the first 20, 30 minutes, They very quickly introduce an antagonistic force, which is basically this company that wants to build this glamping hotel in the middle of this town, of this very rural town. And then there, I'm like, okay, there you go. There's suddenly tension. There's suddenly, it feels like we're building up to something. You know, it feels like these two forces are clashing. And it feels like by the end, you know, we're going to see, do they build the glamping hotel? Do they not build the glamping hotel? So as soon as they introduced that story element, I was like, okay, I'm in. And there's a scene where basically the town people go to a presentation by the people who want to build the glamping, you know, installation. And I thought that scene, that debate in between everyone in the town, incredible, loved it. Amazing, amazing scene. And yeah, overall, I like the movie. I like the movie. It has some pretty nice character moments, specifically when characters are driving. There's a nice interaction concerning, you know, dating apps that I thought it was funny and charming. There's a great moment about, you know, chopping wood. You'll know it when you see it. That said, even though I was enjoying the movie and I was having fun, the ending completely lost me. It just, I don't know. A part of me kind of likes it because it is so weird and it is so out of nowhere. Then, you know, it is thought-provoking. Like, you know, you can't avoid thinking about it. And after the movie was over, you know, the conversations you could hear outside of the movie theater was, what the hell was that? Because that is how weird and strange and out of nowhere it feels. But on the other hand, it also feels strange, out of nowhere, for not really any particular reason. In conclusion, I think Evil Does Not Exist. It's a fine movie. It's a good movie with a slow start and a weird, weird ending that, in my opinion, doesn't really make that much sense. But there's a good chunk in the middle that I was very much enjoying. So if I were to give Evil Does Not Exist a score in between 1 and 10, I would give it a 6 out of 10. I think it's a good movie. Then I saw The Promised Land, and the main reason why I was excited for this movie is because it stars Mads Mikkelsen. For those of you who know me, you know that I've been saying for a while that, in my opinion, the best individual performance I've ever seen in any movie could very well be Mads Mikkelsen in The Hunt. I thought his performance is incredible, and I love him as an actor. He is never bad. He never phones it in. His performances are always through the roof. So as soon as I saw him in the poster, I was like, okay, I guess I gotta go watch The Promised Land. And I thought The Promised Land was a very good movie. You know, it's a historical revenge kind of epic about this farmer who is trying to make this farm in this, you know, in this very untamed place of Denmark. That said, there's another evil rich guy who claims to own all of that land, and he gets jealous of the fact that Mads Mikkelsen is making a farm, and he's basically trying to stop him. And I thought this film was very good. I thought the character of Mads Mikkelsen as like this strong guy who will stop at nothing to make his farm, he will make this work or he will die trying. And I thought that makes for a great protagonist. You know, he's very motivated. It is very clear what his want is, what his desire is, and what his need is. I also thought the, you know, the rivalry between Mads Mikkelsen and this rich, pompous asshole was also very good. It was thrilling, and you just wanted to see the rich guy die. You wanted to see the evil, rich oligarch die a horrible death, which reminded me kind of Joffrey Baratheon from Game of Thrones. But I thought that was great. That said, my problems with the movie comes with the fact that I think it is very unfocused. I think the core story of Mads Mikkelsen building a farm, rich guy doesn't want him to build a farm, mwah, lovely, focused, beautiful, amazing. But I thought the film adds some extra elements with like some savages, I don't remember how they're called, but like another group of people, and then there's this child, and then there's also this woman, and then they kind of fall in love, and then there's a weird romance with, like, the cousin of the rich guy, and then there's a lot going on, and by the end, I'm like, no, this is not necessary, just, you know, focus on Mads Mikkelsen as the farmer versus this other guy, and that would have been enough. And then it becomes even more confusing, because at the end, kind of Mads Mikkelsen stops being the main character, and then, you know, the position of main character gets shifted to this younger girl, and it felt kind of weird, so it felt kind of unfocused. So overall, I would give The Promised Land a 7 out of 10. I think it's a very good movie, but it would have been a lot better if it would have been just a little bit more focused. Then, the next film I saw was actually one of my favorite movies of the festival, and is currently one of my favorite movies of the entire year of 2023. This film is Anatomy of a Fall. This is a French movie directed by Justine Triet. And I absolutely loved this movie. There is something about courtroom dramas that lend themselves for some incredible, delicious scripts, with some amazing monologues, with some amazing dialogue, some incredible performances. You know, narrative structure is all about, you know, a clash between different forces, a protagonist and an antagonist. They're constantly clashing. And what better way to frame that clash than with a courtroom drama, where you literally have two sides clashing, you know, the defendant and the prosecutors, and it was just amazing. I think this film, Anatomy of a Fall, is a courtroom drama in its purest way. I think this is a courtroom drama in its most essential, in its most pure, unrefined form. And what I mean by that is this film shows you the entirety of a courtroom drama. You know, everything that happens in a trial from start to finish. From the moment that, you know, someone gets killed to the very end, to the ending of the trial. I love this film. I thought the script was incredible. I thought the performances were absolutely amazing. The main character is played incredibly by Sandra Hüller. And Sandra Hüller's performance is just outstanding. You know, there is so much subtlety in her performance. There is so much that she shows, you know, in the surface of her face. But there is just as much, if not more, that she's not showing. And every time that you see her, you never know if you should trust her or not. Now, what I love the most about this film is that this is yet another movie that tackles the idea of, is there such a thing as an objective truth? When the movie begins, the crime has already happened. But then we never get a real answer of what actually happened. We hear both sides of the stories, and we see reenactments of both sides of the stories. And then it is up to us, the viewers, to make up our minds and, you know, believe in whatever it is we want to believe in. And I absolutely love that, because I feel like in this film, Justine Triet was perfectly able to put us viewers in the shoes of jury members. You know, we are there, we listen to the facts, we listen to the testimonies, we get the evidence, and then we draw our own conclusion, but we will never know for sure if the conclusion we reached is what actually happened or not. Absolutely incredible film. And the last thing I'll say is, what an amazing dog performance. There is a dog that acts in this movie. He has to do things that I've never seen a dog actor do on screen in my life. I'm like, oh my god, give this dog a dog Oscar, or, you know, whatever it is you give to dogs. All in all, I loved Anatomy of a Fall. Of course, the title is very much a homage to another very famous courtroom drama called Anatomy of a Murder. Anatomy of a Murder is also an incredible, incredible film, but I love Anatomy of a Fall. It is one of my favorite movies of the year. If I were to give it a score between 1 to 10, I would give it a 10 out of 10. I think it's as good as a courtroom drama can get. I think it's exceptional. I think it's a perfect, perfect, beautifully written, beautifully acted movie. Definitely check that one out. Now, the last film I saw on the 30th of September was actually my favorite movie of the entire festival, and also one of my favorite movies of the year. And this is an incredibly experimental movie. It is a film unlike anything I've ever seen before, and it is the newest film from Jonathan Glazer called The Zone of Interest. For those of you who don't know, The Zone of Interest, it's another movie without a plot. It's not a narratively driven movie. It's not a plot-driven movie. This is very much a slice-of-life movie where you're following a family. You're following a family in their day-to-day life. The only caveat is that the family you're following is a family of Nazis, and they live right next to Auschwitz. This is a soul-crushing movie. This is an incredibly, incredibly powerful movie that does a great job, first of all, of depicting the horrors of Nazi Germany and, you know, depicting the horrors of Auschwitz and all of these concentration camps. But it is a fascinatingly experimental film in the sense that, you know, we never see the horrors. We always follow this family. We see them in their house. We see them baking pies. We see them making food. We see them drinking. We see them going to bed. We see them playing with their toys. So in the foreground, we don't really see any of the horrors. But in the background, the horrors are always there. We can always see smoke coming out of chimneys in the background. We can see ashes falling from the sky. We can hear screams. We can hear gunshots. And it is, once again, incredibly soul-wrenching and incredibly, incredibly powerful. And I think what I absolutely loved about The Zone of Interest is that, yes, The Zone of Interest does a great job of showing you, you know, these Nazis as this horrible people who did some horrible, horrible things, but it takes it a step further. And, you know, Jonathan Glazer himself has talked about this in different interviews, I think in Cannes when the film premiered. He even mentioned this, and that is the fact that what he was really trying to do with this film is, yes, to show Nazis as this horrible people who did this horrible, horrible things, but to also show them as humans. Because that is what is the most disturbing about, you know, Nazis and about this period of history. That the people who did all of these horrible, heinous things were humans. They were still human beings. And by making this film, by showing us this slice of life narrative of this, you know, Nazi family, we are forced to confront the fact that these Nazis are a lot more like us than we would like to admit. They come from work and they take off their boots and they go fishing and they have pool parties and they play and they kiss behind their house. They are humans, and that is what is so disturbing. This film is a perfect exploration of, you know, what philosopher Hannah Arendt called the banality of evil. The idea that anyone is capable of evil. And that is what is the most disturbing about this movie. That Nazis are human beings. That people, that real human beings, were capable of doing this heinous, horrible, atrocious things. It is a very powerful movie. It is not a movie that is easy to watch. It is incredibly disturbing, not only because of the things that are depicted in the backgrounds, but also because of the implications and the ideas that this film proposes. You know, the idea that we are all capable of evil, that all humans are capable of evil under the right circumstances. And that is just bone chilling. Incredibly powerful film. I absolutely loved it. And then there are also, by the way, there are also some very experimental, weird moments interspersed between the movie where we see colors and we hear loud noises, and then there is some black and white negative imagery, which is also incredibly thought-provoking, which I won't delve into it right now because I don't want to spoil anything. The last thing I'll say about The Zone of Interest is the ending. The ending does something I would have never expected. It is extremely Brechtian, you know, in the sense that it takes you out of the film, it takes you out of the narrative, intentionally so, in a perfect, perfect way. And that ending just helps drive the point even more. If I were to give The Zone of Interest a score in between 1 to 10, I would give it a 10 out of 10. I think this film is a piece of art. I think this film is an incredibly important, powerful, soul-crushing, incredibly philosophically dense movie that I frankly will never forget. Also, the sound design. Oh, the sound design was incredible. So yeah, you know, if you feel like this is a film you might be interested in watching, definitely go watch it. But do know it is disturbing, it is hard to watch, it is not for everyone. But that is it for part two of everything I watched at VIFF. I hope you enjoyed this, and you know, stay tuned for the next part. Goodbye. Hello, hello. Okay, this is me once again. I hope you all enjoyed all of those movie reviews. Once again, what you just heard is the first two videos that I made where I reviewed the first half of all the movies that I saw at this year's Vancouver International Film Festival. So I saw a total number of 22 films, and these two videos, the one that you just listened to, cover the first half of those movies. So, you know, as you guys saw, I saw some incredible, incredible films. Definitely the highlights of the festival so far out of the ones that you guys have heard. Red Rooms and 32 Sounds, but, you know, above everything else, Anatomy of a Fall and The Zone of Interest were two movies that really, really blew me away. So, considering that, my time is almost over. So, before I sign off, I will just play a song from one of the movies that I just reviewed. I will play a song from Anatomy of a Fall. Anatomy of a Fall is now out in theaters. So, you know, if you've seen the movie, I'm sure you know what the song is going to be. It's a pretty iconic song from the film. It plays a key part in the movie, I guess. So, without further ado, let me play the song from Anatomy of a Fall, and then after that, we will go on a small ad break. And here is the song. Oh.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded, Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Nisiam, Nisiaya, Thikum Queen Ansep, Hydra CM, Nisiam, Nisiaya,
and the Skakuya, Talitin, Homasqueam, Mustail. Are you tired of Big Brother bookstores trying to sell you some billionaire's favorite book or Heather's top picks? Then you should check out Vancouver Books. Vancouver Books is a new online family-run bookstore. A portion of their profits go to First Nations reconciliation and environmental projects in British Columbia. They provide their customers with the most interesting books in fine arts, signed first editions, First Nations photography, fine ancient books, occult, and so much more. They also provide carbon-free delivery to anywhere in the Vancouver area. So go to www.vancouverbooks.ca to check out Vancouver Books today. That's www.vancouverbooks.ca.
Do you love being caffeinated? And do you hate that greedy, soulless international conglomerates are succeeding in the cutthroat world of coffee? Sounds like local coffee roasters Trek Coffee is for you. Trek Coffee is 100% Indigenous and military veteran owned and operated. Let's keep small businesses thriving. Stop by Sunshine Convenience on 4th, the Super Value on Commercial, or Grocery Checkout in the Nest to pick up some Trek Coffee today.
All right, I'm gonna do it. I'm gonna do it raw. I'm about to spit in this mic like freestyle elfin, you know?
Okay, okay. Wait, hold on. Does this make sense?
No, but who cares? All right, let's go. Finally, we. You're not even gonna last. All right. Victoria's pretty good, not bad festival, fountain, just back from France. Montreal, what the
f***? It's a script.
I couldn't even, what? Victoria's pretty good, not bad festival. Fountain okay, just back from France. What are you even saying here? Oh, you're trying to say these are the things featured in this one. You should probably specify that. Because even a f***ing elf couldn't understand that, okay?
Think you can do better than an elf? At CITR, we want to have a variety of voices on the air. Want to write scripts? Do some voice acting? Broadcast your creativity? Volunteer with the CITR production department. No experience? We can also train you in everything required. Send an email to psas@citr.ca to learn more. And don't wait to get your voice on the air.
Interested in making radio? How about hosting your own show? At CITR, you can make your radio dreams come true by joining a collective. From news, art, sports, to gender empowerment, accessibility, music, and the BIPOC collective, there's definitely something for everyone. Explore new worlds both virtually and at our station, and be prepared to have a blast with some new pals. For more information or to join, please visit citr.ca/get involved.
Welcome back. Okay, it's me again. I hope you all enjoyed that musical break. That was, once again, a song from the movie Anatomy of a Fall. But that has been it for this week's video. This week's Take One episode, sorry. If you're interested in listening what I have to say about the other movies that I saw at this year's Vancouver International Film Festival, definitely tune in next week, same time, same day, Tuesday from 3 to 4 p.m., I will be reviewing the remaining films from this year's Vancouver International Film Festival. It has been an honor being your host once again in this week's episode. Definitely tune in. I have some exciting episodes coming for you. By the way, for the entirety of December, there won't be live Take One episodes airing on Tuesdays from 3 to 4. That said, in January, things should go back to normal, and there will be, once again, Take One episodes on Tuesday from 3 to 4 p.m. There's one more week of November, so, you know, next week I will be here, and we will finish our conversation of the film festival and all the films that I saw at VIFF. But after that, in December, I will be taking a little break, just letting you guys know. So, okay, I hope you'll enjoyed those reviews. If you're interested in watching more Take One content, definitely check out my YouTube channel. You can find me by just, you know, searching Take One. Once again, that is Take One, as in my name, J-U-A-N, not one as in the number. But if you look up Take One, you will find my YouTube channel and you'll be able to see, you know, video versions of the reviews that you just listened to, video versions of the interviews that you guys have been listening to, and, you know, all that good stuff. And if you're interested in even more Take One content, then I guess you could potentially follow me on Letterboxd. You can find me under my name, Juan Pablo Sa. That is Sa with double A-S-A-A. And yeah, there in Letterboxd, I'm frequently posting rating. I'm pretty much rating and every once in a while posting written reviews for, you know, movies that I watch. Yeah, that is it for me. That has been this week's episode of Take One. Thank you all so much for tuning in. Goodbye.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Nisiam, Nisiaya, Thinkum Queen Ansep, Hydra CM, Nisiam, Nisiaya, Anthas Gathlia, Talit.